Today is March 8th of 2024. Welcoming to our Chapter 49 podcast. My name is Larry Lannon. I'm a retiree and do some work for Chapter 49, this podcast, and a few other odds and ends. Welcome. It's really good to have you with us. You've taken some time out of your day to be with us for this, what we try to make a weekly podcast as much as we can. Chapter 49 represents most IRS employees in the state of Indiana. And I would like to welcome once again Duncan Giles, our chapter president. Welcome, Duncan.
Thanks, Larry. It's always good to be here.
We have two guests today, and if you're looking on video, you can see that. Two people who have been on our podcast before, and we certainly welcome them back again. Lori McCann is the president of Chapter 10 in Chicago. Lori, welcome. Great to have you back with us.
Thank you, Larry. So great to see you and to see Ken and to see Kim's husband. So great to see you.
Kim's husband. I've been known as Jane's husband many times, so I think I know what you're talking about. But you know, Laurie, I was going to say, Laurie, you always have to start the podcast with some shot at Duncan. You've already done that, so we don't have to worry about it anymore. Ken Moffitt is the director of negotiations for NTU in Washington, D.C. So, Ken, welcome. Always good to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So we're going to start off. We're going to talk a lot about midterm bargaining. We wanted Ken and Lori to be on the podcast because they've just completed some very important bargaining with the IRS on midterm bargaining. We'll talk more about what the issues were and all that. But I want to start off to get everybody's take on the state of the IRS budget. We're recording this the day after the president's State of the Union message. We do know that the machinations in Congress continue. There are two different deadlines for the budget. One's coming up very quickly on us. Looks like the Congress is poised to pass these budgets, although you never know until it's done. And the IRS section of that budget comes later. But I think how this is handled in the first tier will tell us a lot about how it's handled the second tier, which IRS is a part. Let me start with Lori. Lori, you know, you're up in Chicago. You obviously hear a lot from your members. You've been heavily involved in what's going on in Washington. Explain your take on this whole IRS budget issue.
Well, you know, Larry, one issue that really bothers me is that, you know, we're bringing in so many new hires, right? You know, there's some of us, we've been doing this for a long time, so we're kind of used to it. But we're bringing on these new hires, and what we're saying is, welcome to IRS. Congratulations. You may be furloughed in a couple of weeks, and we don't have any space for you to sit in. So what the heck? You know, one thing I just want to say here is that the employees want to do their job. They want to go to work. They want to do the jobs that they were hired for. So we want Congress to do their jobs so we can do our jobs.
From a Washington perspective, Ken, I'm curious, you all talk about this a lot, I'm sure, in the NTU headquarters in Washington. As we speak today, the morning of March 8th, what's the take on where the IRS budget and, frankly, the many agencies that NTU represents, what's the state of budgets right now?
Well, I mean, for us, it's the financial services and government, general government appropriations bill. That's the one that the IRS falls under. And my understanding from talking to our ledge folks is that they are busy in negotiations over, you know, what the FSGG appropriations bill is going to look like. That will tell us what the IRS funding will be. So they have until March 22nd deadline, Friday. I take it that's midnight on March 22nd. Yep. So, you know, like Laurie said, while all of this is going on, the agency, you know, the IRS is operating under a CR, which has kind of built-in limitations without knowing what your budget is. And, you know, here we are in March, and this is a fiscal year budget that should have been passed in, you know, before October 1 or shortly thereafter. The IRS can't make plans to hire figure out what it's going to do in terms of spending additional money in this year because it's restricted by the CR to the same level of last fiscal year. So you have a bunch of different BODs that are trying to hire, including the one that Laurie is in, Taxpayer Advocate Service, have had plans for months to hire more people, more case advocates, more lead case advocates, et cetera. Can't do it, or can do it, I guess, to the extent you're backfilling for attrition positions and that type of thing. So it really kind of hampers the agency's ability to do what it needs to do, you know, under the IRA funding, which was to, you know, make a lot of changes, hire additional FTEs to, you know, change the workforce, improve services, that type of thing.
You know,
so that's where we are in Washington. I mean, we've got how many days? 14 days, I guess. 2 weeks. 2 weeks and a few hours to figure this all out, and hopefully it gets done. You know, we've been pushing for the IRS to, you know, get a budget so that all of these other things can happen, and it is directly linked to the you know, the IRA and the SOP and the TSO and those kinds of initiatives are also hampered by the lack of a budget.
Yeah, we'll talk about those alphabet soup things you mentioned there a little bit later. But Duncan, to dovetail on what Ken just said, IRS has now had 5 full months of a continuing resolution and trying to work on a tax filing season at the same time, which is no easy feat.
Yeah, and especially when you throw in that there are some in Congress that want to pass a retroactive tax deal where they're going to increase the child tax credit and also some business depreciation. If that they throw that in, that's just going to throw everything in a tailspin. My main worry, as it's been the, you know, all these years, is the IRS is going to be treated as a football. Well, you've got the IRA funds. Why do you need a budget? Excuse me. And Commissioner Werfel's gone to the Hill to both the Senate and the House and made very good case on why we need the regular budget as well as the IRA funds to kind of improve service, collect more taxes. We don't have to worry about furloughing employees, and we can get stuff done on a regular basis. And as Ken alluded to, start some of these new initiatives so we can improve things for the taxpayers. We've got 2 weeks to do it, and I'm very frightened that, you know, with all the other, this one was the easy one. The smaller one that's going to be passed by the Senate and signed by the president, I'm assuming by midnight tonight, that's the easy one. That's the smaller one. It's got some controversial things in it that they were worried about, but not the major ones. This one that we're included in is going to be a much tougher road, and I'm very concerned that we'll be able to do it.
So we'll keep you updated as best we can on this podcast and on our Facebook page. But I want to go to the main reason we have Ken and Laurie with us, because midterm bargaining has completed. There is an agreement. Of course, we're waiting on the Treasury to get final approval with their lawyers. But at this point, we know what the provisions are as things stand right now. So, Laurie, you've been through this ringer many times with Duncan at times. But the midterm bargaining is over. I guess I want to just ask you to address a couple of things from your perspective as a chapter president on the bargaining team. How do you think the bargaining went in terms of the back and forth between your team and the management? And talk about what compromises had to be made and what gains employees have made in this midterm bargaining agreement.
Compromises?
Did I use a? I think
Larry,
I used
we
a.
We don't compromise.
Is this a? Is that I use a dirty word? I'm sorry. I'll take
of
it
a
back.
Different union.
Okay, Laurie, I'll let you use the terminology you want to use. I'll let you start, and Ken, I'm sure we'll jump in. But go right ahead.
There was no compromise. Come on now. No, it was. I thought it was very interesting. Is that a good word to say, Ken? With the team, with the agency team. So I'm not going to say that there was a lot of back and forth. I just think that it was interesting conversation. It was, there were 5 articles with midterm. Six could have been opened, but the agency only opened up 2 for whatever reason. So it began once I even saw that, I was like, well, why didn't they open three? Okay. So then we kind of went.
Wait. You're complaining they didn't open more? Is that what I'm hearing coming out of your mouth?
Well, okay. Not that they didn't open more, but there was one, and I won't say which one it was, that I assumed, and you know, we shouldn't assume, that they would have opened that would have made more sense to go along with the two that they did open. Well, at least the one of them that they opened. So it to me, it made bargaining not more difficult. It was just strange. That was just a little strange to me. So, you know, they had a bargaining team. Ken, there were more GLS attorneys this go round.
Yeah, explain what a GLS is just so people know.
General Legal Services.
General Legal Services. We're talking about lawyers, right?
Yes.
So, Ken, let me ask you, because I think there were some important gains for employees here. Explain where you think employees will see a change as a result of this midterm agreement.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that this agreement was, you know, when we approached the opening of this contract, it was a limited reopener. Either both parties have a right to reopen up to three articles. We reopened three articles. And one of the articles that we reopened, we had the right to open it, which was the official time article. But we really went into this thinking that there were a number of things that we wanted to accomplish in each of the articles that we opened that were, you know, pretty specific. And I would say that awards was probably at the top of the list, just in terms of, you know, we've watched what has happened with the IRS funding over the last, you know, couple of years, and getting the IRA funding, which I think was, you know, $80 billion at the beginning and is now $60 billion. So we wanted to improve the awards program. And, you know, we did that. So we made a number of, I think, pretty significant gains there. Overall, in terms of the funding for performance awards, we made a gain. You know, we bumped it up to 2.25% of the way the formula works. It's based on the prior fiscal year base and locality salary of all BUEs. So that 2.25% is probably approaching, is going to approach, you know, $100 million in performance awards funding. It's the first time I think we've ever been above 2%. So that's really good. That's going to result in more than higher awards without any question. The other area was the QSI program. So a long time ago, there was contract language in the national agreement under which, to simplify it, if you met certain criteria, which was that you were outstanding in, you know, three consecutive years, you essentially were guaranteed a QSI. That grew out of some national grievances over Title VII discrimination. The IRS wanted to get out of that agreement in the national agreement in 2015 because it was resulting in essentially every 3 years there was a huge spike in QSIs that were mandatory by the contract. The problem for Treasury was that is that there's a government-wide regulation that basically says QSIs, the determination to grant or not to grant a QSI is discretionary on the part of the agency. So they essentially had bargained away that discretion in the national agreement. And in 2014-15 time period, they wanted to get that discretion from the government-wide reg back, which they did. So the problem with the QSI program from that point on is that they essentially granted the QSIs after the fiscal year in which the employees are rated outstanding, which means if you got your evaluation in December of last year, you were not going to get your QSI until this coming November. So you essentially have to wait 11 months for a QSI. And the regulation basically says that, you know, the importance of the QSI is to reward outstanding performance, and it should be granted to the employee in close proximity to when they get their rating. So by having this delay, and the agency's argument on the delay was, well, we don't know, you know, how much money we're going to have. You know, there's not an unlimited amount of funding during the course of the fiscal year to grant QSIs to everyone who's outstanding. So we're going to have to wait till the end of the year or until the first quarter of the next fiscal year to grant them. I mean, that kind of always rang a bit hollow for us because you're basically saying, you know, out of a $13 billion budget, you know, you can't determine whether or not X number of people who are outstanding should be rewarded for that outstanding performance. So anyway, in this contract negotiation, we had proposed that basically QSIs be granted at the time that the employee gets the rating. And now we understood that, you know, it's still going to have to go through this process of, you know, recommendations and approval and that type of thing. But we didn't want it to happen so late so that it penalizes essentially employees who could be getting the quality step increase during the course of the fiscal year. So what we agreed to is after some back and forth is they're going to grant QSIs over at like seven different points during the fiscal year. So that means whenever your rating becomes due, which is based on the last number of your Social Security number, then you would be considered at that point in time. So it goes, you know, 0 to 9 during the course of the fiscal year. So, you know, I think that's going to be something that really helps both employees and the agency. You know, it's gonna result in a more immediate reward to those who are performing at the highest levels. Not to mention the fact that for several years now, the IRS, probably more than several years since probably 2019. When we started looking at attrition data, the IRS has a huge attrition problem, probably like 15 to 20% per year. Some of that is people that retire, and a lot of that is people who walk away from the agency because they're dissatisfied with one thing or another, or maybe 18 things or 40 things. But anyway, that's a problem. Because you're spending a lot of money on having to hire people just to maintain your current level of FTEs. So to the extent that you can do anything, this was the argument that we made with them at the table, to the extent that you can do anything to reward employees, either in terms of, you know, higher awards for those that are performing at a high level, QSIs, that type of thing, that would be a good thing to try to reduce the number of people that walk out the door.
You know, Duncan, you know,
I'm sorry,
go ahead, Lori.
I was just going to interject one thing. I think that the awards was just a great win for employees. And not only the 2.25, the 90-10 for the MPAA and the
bilingual
special ag. No, the special ag bilingual went up. And so I call Ken. I have another name for him. I'm going to give it to him. Ken Million Dollar Man Moffitt.
Not reflected in my bank account.
It was because he was looking at those numbers. We were looking at them, and we were just driven. And as Ken just stated, you know, so many employees are going out the door. And then you have the agency, they're paying incentives. They're hiring incentives. So you have hiring incentives for new hires, and then you have, you know, your seasoned employees, and you don't want to pay them with awards. So I just think that this was a win-win-win situation for the employees.
Let me bring Duncan in here because, you know, Duncan, that's the first thing that struck me when I looked at the summary of all the midterm bargaining agreements that were reached. You know, obviously the official time is important for internal union business for people who have to manage that. But it was the awards agreement that stuck out. And for me, as somebody who received QSIs as an employee, it's a great it's a great award because it follows you throughout your career. And also, as a manager, I loved recommending QSIs for my employees. And the increase in the awards pool, as Laurie said, it's in the millions. So we'll call Ken the million-dollar man now. But as somebody, Duncan, who is a chapter president, has been for a long time, and has also served on some of these national bargaining teams, I'd like your thoughts on these major gains for people, particularly being rewarded for the good work they do.
Yeah, well, first off, I've just been thinking about that. If he's million-dollar Ken, I guess I'm $10 Duncan. But, no, I think the team did a great job, and especially framing it to the IRS to say, look, you've got a huge retention problem. You're paying all these bonuses to people off the street. This is really irritating the people who are training them, busting their butts, doing a great job. And the QSI thing has been forever. You know, I was there when we were at the Federal Services Impasse panel trying to figure out what we can do about QSIs with Ken. And the agency was just like, nope, it's going to be discretionary. It's going to be discretionary. So they've made it discretionary, but they made it so that nobody knew when they were going to get their QSI, you know, what the determination was. And it's still going to be managers are going to be doing what upper level management does sometimes and figuring out who gets it or what percentage of employees get it, no matter how many deserve it. But it's a great thing to at least have some time frames that it'll be rewarded by. So I think the team did a great job on the awards as a whole, and I think it's going to be very good for employees. They will see, you know, people going, well, it went from 2% to 2.25%. That doesn't sound like that much. When you're talking bargaining unit employees' salaries, another quarter of a percent is literally millions of dollars that'll be put in that pot to increase the award amount. So I think it's a great thing.
Well, Duncan,
based on the figure,
if I can just say something, I want to ask Ken to come in, and I want to just say, if Duncan, if you're $10 Duncan, I'm buck and a half Larry. But I want to ask, I want to ask Ken, and I know you'll address what you're about to say, but I also wanted you to address one thing. If I'm a bargaining unit employee, let's say at the IRS, and I tend to get performance awards each year, I know that's it's a wide range, how many people qualify and so forth. It's quite a mathematical calculation. But can you just give me maybe a rough example of how someone who normally does receive a performance award might see more money in their award in the coming years?
Yeah. The way that the award program is structured, and this was done back in probably 2000, 2001, by my predecessor and some folks at some executives at the IRS. The way it's structured is you have the funding amount, and then you have the ability to earn shares, award shares. And the number of shares that you are entitled to get that turn into money, into a cash award, is based on two things: your rating of record, which is your average of your 68-50, and your grade. So if you have a 4.4 as a score, you multiply that by your grade, like 4.4 by grade 9, you can figure out the total number of shares that you would be entitled to if you qualify. Now, qualification is based on what pool you're in, and whether or not you're in the top 55% plus ties. So initially, when you look at it, top 55% plus ties that's a lot of people. That's like we're talking about tens of thousands of people, because it's not, you know, top 30 or top 40. It's top 55 plus ties. So and then the share value is pretty simple. We simplified it so that with it. It's no longer done by division. which would be like on a pro rata basis. But the basically you take the total number of shares that are out there for all eligible employees, and you divide the total amount of funding by the shares, and you get the value of one share. So then you go back to the, I've got a 4.4 rating, I'm a grade 9, I've got, you know, 38 or whatever, 40 shares. Then you multiply the 40 shares by the whatever the share value is, let's say it's $55, and you get your award amount. The higher your score on your 6850 and the higher your grade, then the more money that you're going to get. But when you talk about the share value, that's where the funding becomes important, because the more money that's in the pot means the share value is going to, on an enterprise level, is going to go up. So that's something that I, and what I was going to say was that this point, the 0.25% that we increased it per year, based on the current data, it's about $10.6 million increase to the awards.
That's awesome.
Cool. Which is, that's a lot of money.
That's awesome.
So, yeah. And one other thing that we did on awards that I thought was also good is there's a number of people in the bargaining unit. I don't know exactly how many, because some of them are also not in the bargaining unit. But there's a number of people that are in campuses that are signers for the deaf and hard of hearing community. And there are a number of bargaining unit employees that we have that are in that community. And those folks were not getting any kind of special recognition for all of the work that they do, which is collateral to their main job if they're in the bargaining unit. So one of the things that we had proposed and actually won was that they would also be entitled to a bilingual award. We kind of just changed the nature of the bilingual award to include them. So they're also now going to be entitled to not just a performance award, but also, you know, $850 a year if they perform as a signer. You know, these are like informal discussions and that type of thing that they have on campuses or wherever. So that's one of the things that we also wanted to, we wanted to win that provision, and we did.
If you're somebody proficient in sign language and you leave IRS and go somewhere else, you can make a pretty good living out of that. So the idea that you are now at least rewarding those people. I want to get to a couple of other issues before we leave this. So Laurie, any other comments or anything else you want to say to people who are listening about this midterm bargaining agreement?
One thing I want to add is that we worked on and I'm really happy about is in the telework in the Article 50 about medical telework, and that's a new section. And the reason that it was that we proposed it was because there's sometimes that an employee may be in a situation where they need to waive coming into the office. So let's say they're frequent and they have to come in. They're on frequent telework and they have to come in 2 days, a pay period. But let's say that I'm going to say have a cold, or they may even have COVID, or, you know, or something like that, or broke a foot, something like that. Well, they don't need to do a reasonable accommodation, but they just need to not go into the office for a week or two. And sometimes that would become an issue with managers where they would not waive it, which is kind of ridiculous. And I just had that situation the other day where an employee could not go into the office on their in-office day because they were ill, but they felt well enough to be able to work, but they just could not do the commute. And so the manager said, well, no, if you're sick, you have to take sick leave for that day. So even though them, you know, so they didn't get the work from the employee that day, even though they were able to work. So this was a big win for us, I believe, because this is a situation that happens over and over again. So that's new. That's in the Article 50. So I think that's great.
So, Kim, just briefly, anything else you think people listening or watching would need to know about this agreement?
Yep. We talked so far about our interests, and I think it would be worth mentioning one of the main interests that the IRS had was the trying to figure out whether or not there's a way to expedite the hoteling process, the negotiation over hoteling.
And going one of the 15 to 1?
Yeah, at least. So, you know, they had made at the outset, they had made a number of proposals that we thought were permissive and, you know, basically required us to waive a number of things. But at the end of the day, in Article 11, we reached an agreement over a bit of a cleaner process on hoteling, where if they're just doing hoteling without any other space changes, Article 47, that's the midterm bargaining article, that requires them previously, before this contract, required them to give pre-decisional involvement input for the chapter, including on everything, hoteling, that type of thing. And in this contract, what we did in Article 11, Section 20, is we basically agreed that if they're just doing hoteling, converting workstations from individual workstations to those that are going to be shared by employees that are deemed under the applicable criteria to be out of office, which is, you know, more than 80 hours a month, those that are unfrequent, et cetera, then they don't need to give the chapter PDI. They can just initiate bargaining formally on that. And that should it will help the IRS. I mean, it's a process that they've had all along to do. I'm not going to get into what my opinion is on how they've managed that process, because it's not very good. But, you know, and this is something that we've been talking to them about, you know, desk sharing and hoteling for easily over 14 years, 15 years. Even when it was frequent telework was called occupational flexi-place. This is a way for, you know, we understand that that both parties have an interest in this, to the extent that they need space to hire more people. We want them to have the space available. And if there are workstations that are used twice out of a pay period by one person and other people can use that same workstation, then we're, you know, we're on board with, you know, converting those into hoteling or desk sharing workstations so that it can accommodate more people. And if you were to look at, for example, TAS and their need to hire case advocates, that's a perfect example. Does TAS need more case advocates? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, you have folks that are working that are carrying like 130, 140 cases. They need more folks to help out, to spread out the work. So to the extent that we can assist the agency in doing that, you know, that's one of the things that I think that should result in hopefully an easier process for them.
So Duncan, anybody who's listened or watched this podcast knows you have some very particular ideas about this hoteling thing. But that or anything you would like to say just based on what you have seen in this midterm bargaining that we need to talk about before we move on?
Yeah, the two things. One is on hoteling, absolutely. If there's a need, in other words, there's not enough office space, you know, Lori and I have a shared interest up in the Chicago area region where there's a lot of people up there and not many spaces. So we have to do desk sharing. But if you're in a place like a federal building that has hundreds of desks that are empty, and yet you're saying, okay, we need to do desk sharing right now, I sort of give them my puppy dog look and just sort of like, okay, why? There's no real reason for that. So I think that this is going to help streamline that a little bit. The second thing I want to say is there, you know, once that came out about Congress pushing on return to work, return to the office, not return to work because we have been working, return to the office. And people are saying, okay, well, what's going to happen with this? I know we're in bargaining. Nothing is happening. Nothing is changing. Our standards are still the same. When you see them talking, you're seeing them talking about non-bargaining folks in the D.C. region, not bargaining unit employees in the rest of the country. If they want to come and, you know, try and get more folks back to work, bargaining unit, they're going to have to serve notice to Doreen and Ken and we'll have to gear up for that rodeo. But as of now, and anything I've heard, that's not happening. And, you know, we've beaten back any suggestion that they start doing that informally or anything of that nature. So I was very glad the team was all over that as well.
So when people get their next check or direct deposit on their awards, and it's a bigger amount, thank the people we're talking to right here because they helped make that happen. Ken, I want to bring you in on something that I just learned about yesterday. President Biden has issued a new executive order on labor management committees, and I'd like for you to just talk about what that executive order says and how it may or may not impact how NTEU and IRS interact with each other.
Yeah, I just read it yesterday. We're going to be having discussions with them about it. I mean, it's essentially rescinds the executive order that had existed under the prior administration that essentially got rid of the labor management forum that existed in the prior administration. But so we've really come full circle. We look at it as a positive thing. You know, we think that this executive order has PDI in it, pre-decisional involvement of the union. You know, that's something that we have been pushing where we can get it. And if we're going to talk about that TSO agreement, that's an area where we're going to get PDI. So, yeah, I mean, we welcome the executive order, even if it's in the, you know, the final year of the administration, at least in the, you know, this term of the administration. We'll see what happens in November. But yeah, we are a huge proponent of the union and the agency getting together and talking about things that are going to be changing. Any kind of initiative that's going to be changing. You know, there you can get the input of employees who do the work on the front line, or you can go out and hire vendors to basically dictate what, you know, people that have never worked in the agency to dictate how change is going to occur. You know, our view is that it's always better to get the input of employees who are doing the actual work. And you know, we had a meeting yesterday with TAS, a couple of folks at TAS executives that were talking about collaboration on, you know, they're looking at potentially replacing the TAMIS system, which is the system that case advocates and others use for their work. And they are very welcoming in terms of, you know, getting our input and meeting with us and collaborating on it. So, yeah, I think, you know, it just the ink is still drying on that executive order. But, you know, we're going to look at it, and where we can, we will be pushing for, you know, these labor management forums and getting PDI for both chapter leaders and bargaining unit employees.
As somebody who as a manager and as a union official has seen these executive orders come and go, it's been my experience that the more you get the employees involved, the better solutions you come up with. But I want to talk about what Ken just alluded to, something called TSO, a TSO agreement. So I'm going to bring Laurie in because Laurie's going to have a very important part to play in this. Explain what TSO stands for and why employees should have an interest in this.
Well, you know, and it kind of goes hand in hand, and I'll get to that in just a second, with the executive order. You know, and I know that you were around for quite a while, Larry, and all of us have, and you go back to the quality circles. How about that? So that kind of tells you how I'm aging myself there. But when you have people that have boots on the ground, the ones that actually do the work, that can help identify problems, you know, and propose solutions, I think that we end up, that's a win-win situation for everyone. So I was excited about the executive order. Now we can talk about TSO, and I'm happy about that because, you know, if the agency is changing, and it is, and they there's five levels to it, there's a lot to it. And with this particular issue that we're going to work with, but they need to have input from the ground level. And this is what's going to happen here. So as I stated with this transformation office, what we're going to do is there, like I said, there's five levels to it. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head, Larry. Now there's five different levels to it. And they're going to have meetings, monthly meetings with different leaders. And so we're going to have input at that level. And I think that is interesting. Some of it has to do with employee experience. So I know some of the teams are already up and working, for example, the employee experience, and that's in 5.3, I believe. So they have the five, level one, level two, level three, four, five, and then they have subsections under that. I'm interested in that 5.3, the employee experience, because what they're doing is they're looking at mental health issues. How can they help employees? So there's all type of things. This started from a conversation with the commissioner, Commissioner Werfel. He met with chapter leaders. First, we met virtually, and we discussed concerns that we had. And then we met all together in Kansas City, and that's how these five different levels were established. So it was input from the beginning, from chapter leaders. So we will be there. We're going to work on these different issues. And and the agreement was just signed, I think, on the 6th. Is that right, Ken? Was that the
6th? Yes.
It was signed on the 6th. So we're going to get started with that. But this came directly from conversations between the chapter leaders and the commissioner. So I'm looking forward to it.
We're running out of time, Duncan, so any comments you'd like to make on first the executive order from the president on labor management committees and the TSO? What anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think, the labor management executive order is a great thing. Anytime that we can get sitting, talking, discussing issues is always great. On the TSO, I think that Ken and his folks did a great job on negotiating this to make sure that, like Lori said, it came from a germ of a discussion between chapter leaders and the commissioner, and he's shown a willingness to realize that if you want to change the IRS, you'd best be talking to the people who are doing the work and those representing those who are doing the work that know what's going on, not a consultant coming in from the outside who's never dealt with it. So I think that this is going to be very, very helpful. I'm very thankful to Ken and Lori for all they've been doing lately. I'm finally glad they're picking up some slack.
You hear that lately, Ken?
But no, I think both of them are great things.
We have to be respectful of people's time. We were a little over time already, so I would appreciate a little if you could be a little bit brief in this. I want to ask Ken and then Lori, anything you'd like to add to this discussion before we wrap it up this time? Ken, you can start.
I don't think so. I mean, I'm very, very grateful for the folks that we had on the midterm bargaining team, including Laurie and Terry Scott and Jason Sisk, and all of the other chapter leaders. I mean, one of the things Laurie alluded to is the different experience level of the folks that we have when we go to the collective bargaining table. It's a big deal, I think, in the sense that we've always had folks at the table that have, in my view, superior knowledge than the folks that the IRS brings to the table. And the IRS, they have a couple of good people that were at the table. But it's a real pleasure to work with folks that have, 20 plus years of experience. You can really drill down on what's going on in the workplace a lot better with folks that have to deal with, a lot of different bods and a lot of different issues. I think, we're very happy with where we landed on the term agreement. It's going to last for 3 more years and, we'll see what happens from there.
Lori, your final chance. Anything to add to all that?
I just want to say, you know, I think that we got good terms under this midterm agreement due to the guidance by Ken Million Dollar Moffitt and also Doreen. And I want to say, I appreciate all of the chapter leaders that were at the table and who weren't at the table, who provided input for us. And also Dan Casper, I think we have a wonderful national office, and I appreciate the support that we receive from them. So I want to say for it, whether it's bargaining or we're looking at this executive order or TSO or whatever it is, I think that if we all work together, then we're going to be very successful. So I appreciate everyone, even Duncan.
Well, $10 Duncan, anything you'd like to add?
I think she said it all right there. We're good.
Well, from Bucket, I think you should be $20 Duncan.
Thank you, Ken.
Well, maybe I can go up from Bucket.
Negotiating on my behalf.
I'll go up from Bucket and a half to three.
Inflation at all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for a great discussion. We had fun, but we also, I think, expressed a lot of what people should be looking forward to as a result of the work that's being done at the national level and by chapter people all throughout NTEU. Thank you so much, Ken Moffitt, and Lori. Thank you so much for your time, Duncan. Thanks for being with us as always. This is Larry Lannon, appreciating the fact that you're with us. And please, be safe and be kind.